Hello, and welcome back for another affiliate-focused branch of the UF Care Podcast. These are conversations with early career professionals studying addiction research here at the University of Florida, as well as providing advice and support for those entering the field. My name is Victor. I'm a rising third-year graduate student here in the Department of Clinical Health Psychology, working with Dr. Jeff Boisinot. And today we're joined by the one and only Marilyn Orta. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. How's your day going?
Everything's going well so far.
Glad to hear it. I know you mentioned that your dog might be barking in the background, but we'll try to edit those out.
Okay.
Or not. We'll see how we're feeling.
She's a great time either way. So.
So today I've got some questions for you about your career, where you've been, where you're going, about your dissertation and the process of becoming a postdoc here at UF. And then advice for other early career professionals or folks interested in getting started down the same path that you are on. So first, Marilyn, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. So I'm starting my second year in a postdoc appointment through the UF NIDA T32 program. I'm under the mentorship of Dr. Roger Fillingham, and I'm continuing some of the graduate work that I did with Dr. Natalie Ebner as well. So my previous background is in oxytocin administration research, primarily focused in aging populations, looking at how oxytocin administration affects the social lives of older adults, specifically how they process emotions. And my focus in my dissertation was looking at how oxytocin administration affects brain connectivity within older adults and in the processing of different dynamic audio and visual emotions. Since then, I'm transitioning into substance use and chronic pain research, which still within older adults, interested in how chronic pain specifically influences decision making and the decisions to use certain substances as well.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of really cool work over the years. Your work moving from oxytocin now to chronic pain and decision making. I guess I'm trying to think, would it be better to start like talking about your time with oxytocin and then paint the picture of how you shifted towards chronic pain?
Yeah. When I was an undergrad at Florida State University studying psychology. And during that time, I thought that I was going to be a child developmental psychologist. But with different research experiences, I was kind of able to broaden my horizons. And I gradually started getting into neuroscience research.
What sort of research experiences did you have?
So in the beginning, I was looking at courageous behavior. That's basically my freshman year in undergrad. That's the first thing that I did. And that kind of sparked my interest in pro-social behavior in particular. If you don't know already, oxytocin initially was associated with pro-social behaviors. So that's kind of like the connecting line between that. But throughout undergrad, I had this growing interest in neuroscience. But I didn't necessarily have those opportunities in the beginning to engage in that research. So basically, I applied for a summer program at the University of Pittsburgh, where I did a behavioral neuroscience research in cebus monkeys, looking at motor sequence learning, specifically in the context of Parkinson's disease. So that undergraduate experience was super informative for me, basically letting me know that neuroscience is the direction that I want to go, but probably not human. I'm not probably not monkeys, sorry. Mm-hmm. And to rather go into human research. And so beyond that, there was a gap in my training. So I really wanted to do neuroimaging research in particular by the end of my undergraduate experience. And that's what brought me to a post-bac position at Emory University. And that was with Dr. James Rilling. And he does oxytocin research. So that was my first introduction to oxytocin. And then basically from there, I was able to use these accumulated experiences and apply for graduate school. And that's where I got involved in oxytocin research in particular. And from there, we looked at, with the mentorship of Dr. Natalie Ebner, we looked at the effects of single dose oxytocin on older adults. And we were in the process of developing a chronic administration study in which we have older adults self-administer for 4 weeks intranasal oxytocin. So it's a longer term intervention. So really the trajectory of my research experience started changing once I started thinking more about what the effects of chronic oxytocin administration looked like in different populations. So I was able to write a review paper on chronic oxytocin administration across various different areas of research, and that includes pain and substance use. So that's kind of like the long-term trajectory of how I got to the research that I'm doing today. But it was really, so for early career researchers, I want to really emphasize how formative a summer undergraduate research experience was for me to get to this point today.
So yeah, it really does sound like those summer experiences that you got in undergrad helped you figure out the kind of research that you were actually interested in, and then make those connections to help you fill the gaps in your research in the future, like getting you towards the work that you want to be doing.
Yeah, everything really built on top of each other after undergrad, starting with the post-bac experience specifically.
How did you find those experiences for undergrads who might be listening?
Yeah, so Google is your best friend, definitely throughout this whole process. But I became really good at just like talking to people and making sure that if they had knowledge to share or if they had skills to share, to kind of be inquisitive and just ask the right questions along the way. There's so much available out there that if you're just starting out, like you might get a little bit overwhelmed or something like that, but I think like over time you can refine your interest and you can refine your research identity. And there are so many different opportunities available that can help you do so, but definitely starting with Google, NIH website is another good resource to look at. So that's how I found my post-bac experience in particular, was looking at the NIH website.
Okay. All right. So folks, ask around and also Google.
Yeah.
That's the answer. So Marilyn, once you got into the oxytocin work, the work that you first felt kind of excited about, what did you do with that? Like, how did you develop it over time? What was that process of, because this is what your dissertation was about, right? The oxytocin work with the older populations.
Yeah. So basically how the graduate experience was, for my master's project, I was working off of existing data, from a study that had concluded before I entered graduate school. And then, at the same time, I was working towards setting up this clinical trial of, chronic oxytocin administration with my advisor, Natalie Ebner. And basically, there's different milestones within the psychology department at UF, but I modeled each of the different milestones in graduate school towards the dissertation. And this, of course, was done under the advisement of my mentor. So basically, while I was working on my master's project with existing data, I was helping set up a study that the data collected from that would end up being my dissertation. And then for my qualifying exam, I wrote a review paper that would set me up in a good place in order to complete that dissertation at the end.
So it sounds like each project that you did was used to set up your next project.
Yeah. And that's something that I would advise younger students to think about as well, and to work with your mentor on, because in the end, this is your opportunity to gain your own individualized training in the research that you want to do. So you want to make sure that those milestones are in the end serving your training.
So then you were able to do the dissertation. What did you find, by the way?
So for my dissertation, it was a combination of looking at behavioral findings and resting state connectivity findings within older adults that self-administered 4 weeks of chronic intranasal oxytocin or a placebo. In terms of the behavioral findings, we used a dynamic emotion identification task that looked at various different types of emotions. Some emotions are not as well researched. That's including the emotions pride, relief, and worry in particular. But we also looked at the more common emotions that have been studied in the past: joy, anger, and fear. So these emotions are presented by professional actors, and they could be video clips, audio clips, or a combination of video and audio. And we were interested in how older adults would respond to these different dynamic stimuli. Basically, we found that that positive emotions were the easiest to identify across the board. However, once you looked at individual modalities, audio emotions were the more difficult modality to identify. That's because there's less contextual information that is being provided through an audio modality. Whereas the video and the audio plus video, they did pretty well with mm-hmm. those. And then the negative emotions were a little bit more difficult to identify. And then we looked at their resting state connectivity, and we compared the behavior in the behavioral task with their resting state patterns. We found that there was increased resting state connectivity of the anterior insula, but not the amygdala or the medial prefrontal cortex. And this was related to improved emotion identification in the chronic oxytocin group compared to the placebo group.
So for podcasts, what does this mean? What does this mean for me, Marilyn?
Yeah, so that's such a good question, because I was actually thinking about this in the context of like phone calls. For older adults, that they receive phone calls, and some of these phone calls might not be made with the best intentions. So there's increasing work being done in terms of financial exploitation and scams or something like that.
Interesting.
If older adults are not able to appropriately identify the emotions that are being conveyed, that could tie into their abilities to perceive deception or not. And over the phone might be one context. But yeah, in terms of podcasts, we definitely try as much as possible to communicate information that would otherwise be communicated verbally. I know a lot of podcasts are including video as well as the audio, and that could be a supporting feature as well to help individuals get like the full experience of a social interaction.
Interesting. I'm going to have to consider that, because, you know, it a little off topic, I guess. We are trying to make a podcast that is helpful for people. It sounds like you're saying that just the audio, there might be sections of the population. That's an excellent point. Marilyn, I'm going to have to think on this one for a little bit.
Yeah.
Huh.
I think representation is a good thing too. Like if you include the video, people could see individuals that look like themselves as well.
Absolutely. Gosh. Okay. I'm gonna have to take some time to think about this. But my own existential podcasting crisis aside the point. so you did the dissertation. It was a smash hit, and then you got a job as a postdoc here at UF.
Yeah.
As your work changed to chronic pain. Something else has been going on the last 2 years, though, and that is the pandemic. So I actually wanted to pick your brain on what the experience of starting a postdoc in the age of COVID-19, what that was like.
Yeah. So it was a very unique experience, to say the least. I was actually like one of the first people to also defend their dissertation over Zoom. So it even started a little bit before the postdoc experience. So the whole interview process was over Zoom. Applications were online. The one advantage that I think I had was that I wasn't changing institutions. So at least I was familiar with the resources that would be available to me, and I was really confident in the position that I was going to be entering in the future. Granted that there's still significant amount of challenges that have happened to all of us as a function of trying to survive this pandemic, but I felt super supportive by not only CARE, but the Price Center as well, Pain Research Excellence Center, individuals from the IMPART T32 program as well.
Marilyn, how did you find that postdoc?
You got to ask questions. You got to talk to people.
Same thing. Same rules apply. Undergrad, grad school.
Yeah. Get to know people. Like, people are excited to talk about what's going on in their departments and their own research. So I basically found out through word of mouth that there was an opening available, and I was able to apply. And that's where I got to where I'm at right now. Mm-hmm.
Well, congratulations on all your successes so far.
Thank you.
What is next for you?
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, I'm working with Dr. Fillingen, we submitted an application for a pilot grant that was approved. So I'll be starting my own pilot project pretty soon. I'm working on the IRB revisions for that now. We're going to be looking at chronic pain patients, older adults in particular, that have musculoskeletal pain. And I'm interested in how that chronic pain impacts decision-making. So we'll be having older adults engage in a decision-making task online. Because of the COVID restrictions, of course, I wanted to make sure that I had a remote study going on. And I'm interested in how their decision-making behaviors relate to certain health risk factors, in particular substance use, their motivations behind substance use, and their rates of substance use as well. And then along with that, seeing how their decision-making patterns also relate to different psychosocial factors that should be under consideration, like their sleep, their loneliness, and overall well-being, and seeing if we could identify certain connections between decision-making ability under chronic pain and substance use and quality of life, pretty much. And if there is certain deficits in those places, how can we fill that with different treatment approaches?
Interesting. What's the timeline? When do we think we'll have the paper to look at?
Yeah. So the pilot is set for 1 year. Okay. I'm in the process of setting it up right now. So I'm hoping to start data collection very soon, and then see how things go 6 months from now. And then 6 months after that, hopefully there'll be a product available.
Okay. I'm excited to see how it goes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Before we resolve our conversation for today, I feel like we could keep talking, and I'd like to keep talking with you sometime. But for the purpose of this episode, I'd like to end with one more question, which is, in addition to all the advice that we've had in our conversation today for undergrads and younger grad students and all of them, what is just the key piece of advice that you'd like to pull out and present to them on a platter? What is the key thing that you'd like them to keep in mind if they look at the work that you're doing and think, gosh, I'd like to do, that's the kind of thing that I want to do. That's the path I want to take.
So the key piece of advice I would say is to remember that you belong, that that there is a place for you here. And that if there is something that you are super passionate about, that is of interest to you, that there are people around you that will support those interests. So kind of like check that fear at the door and claim the space that you're in. That's pretty much what I would say.
I think that's excellent, Marilyn. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk today. I really appreciate it.
Of course. I had fun.
Well, we also want to give a quick thanks to the University of Florida Center for Addiction Research and Education, Dr. Oliver Grundman, Dr. Sarah Jo Nixon, Dr. Joanne Paris, and all of our mentors and future collaborators. Thank you very much.